This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, I'm Mark Stephen. I'm currently sitting in my back garden in northeast Scotland. The sun is shining, it's really quite pleasant. But it's not freezing, it's not broiling. I'm not terribly high off the ground, and nor am I terribly deep. In fact, I've got a kettle 20 feet away. In short, where I am is not terribly adventurous. Now, the idea of adventuring has taken on a whole new meaning in recent months because of lockdown. We're forced into local adventures of a very different kind. I mean, that's stuff like, you know, cycling up a track you've never been before, or sleeping under the stars in your back garden, or maybe swimming in the local beach at dawn. Circumscribed, yes, but not without appeal. Joining me now is a woman who always likes a bit of adventure, Helen Needham.
Hello. Well, I feel like I've been adventuring in my own patch a lot more recently, discovering new corners I hadn't really taken the time to explore before. The main difference being, I think, that I've not been driving, but walking and cycling, and just seeing the world differently as a result of that. Adventure is at the very core of our podcast guest today. Adventure's on a way bigger scale than I think either of us have ever attempted.
Way, way beyond anything we've ever tried. Jenny Tough, or Tuch, is an adventurer, writer, award-winning filmmaker who's undertaken umpteen physical challenges around the globe, some of them in places that people just normally don't go, including a serious world first, traversing solo the mountains of Kyrgyzstan. She's almost completed a challenge of running across a mountain range in every populated continent of the world, and she's just edited a new book called Tough Women, which features adventure stories from women around the world. Jenny, as you could hear, joins us now from Canada. Where exactly are you?
I'm in beautiful Squamish, British Columbia. Squamish is kind of Canada's biggest climbing scene, but it's also got quite a lot of mountain biking, road biking, obviously in the winter skiing. Like, it's just really one of our adventure capitals. We've got the ocean, we've got the mountains. It's absolutely what I would call paradise on earth.
It sounds like paradise on earth. Now, as I've already said, your name is Tough, or Tuch. Tuch is a very, very northeast Scottish name. You grew up in the Canadian Rockies, but what is the connection with Scotland?
So my dad's actually Scottish, and he married a Canadian, so hence me. I'm a dual citizen. I called Scotland home for the last 8 years, actually. I'm told that my accent's starting to morph a little bit, which I'm not sure, but maybe it's there.
I've actually been to Squamish. It's a great place, wonderful. It just felt like the kind of place. We were only there for a couple of days, but could have stayed there for a lot longer. You grew up in the Rockies. How do you think actually growing up in those mountains shaped you as a person and the choices that you've made about where to go and explore in the world?
You know, as a kid, I probably underestimated just how much of an impact the outdoor environment had on my life. You know, because it's just where you grow up, you just think, well, everywhere is probably like this. You know, this is normal. But, you know, the advantage was that I got to spend a lot of time in the outdoors and I got to build outdoor skills. You know, my summer camps were genuinely pretty gnarly stuff for children to be doing and learning hiking skills and backcountry skills. So the outdoors, I guess, throughout my upbringing just kind of became my sanctuary, became the place that I really love to go. I always look forward to the weekend being out in Banff and Jasper and playing in the mountains. And travel was always something that I really loved and was really important to me. So as soon as I was legally able to, pretty much I left the house and went exploring the world. But one thing I found was that I never really got homesick, but I did really miss the mountains. And I could get homesick for just mountains in general. So then I would end up seeking out other mountains around the world, and I found that no matter where they were, no matter what language the humans within them spoke, I felt at home if I was in mountains somewhere.
What is it about mountains that makes you feel at home?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, and I think that's largely why I launched this project, that I was going to go across a mountain range on every continent, because then I would explore all these different ones that all have very different cultures living within them. But what I've found almost immediately when I started the project was that there were huge commonalities. You know, there were things that, even though I couldn't speak the same language as the people that I met, we understood each other on some kind of common ground. I have a theory that the most inhospitable places to live on the world have the most hospitable people living within them. And that's what I want to find out in this project. And so I'm almost done, so I better come up with my answer soon.
It's interesting, though, because it's almost the law of opposites. It's not just, you know, inhospitable places breed hospitable people. The less people have, the more generous they tend to be.
Oh, absolutely. That's something I would absolutely agree to from travelling the world, yeah.
Well, shall we focus in on the mountain challenges then? Talk us through the locations of the Run the Mountain challenge you set yourself. Explain the concept.
So it was only ever meant to be that I was going to run across Kyrgyzstan, and that was by far the hardest thing I'd ever set for myself. I came across the Tian Shan, and as soon as I saw a picture of them, you ever have that moment where your heart stops and goes, my life isn't complete until I've been there? And that's how I felt about the Tian Shan. So I decided I would run across this country, which is completely covered by the central Tian Shan, mainly because I thought if I cycled across it, I would get there too fast and I just wouldn't get enough of it. So I thought running will slow things down. It's about 1,000 kilometers, and there were no good maps and no one had ever done it before, which meant that there was no route. So I had to, you know, play explorer and do everything the old fashioned way and figure out how to solve the problem. How on earth would I get from A to B? And it was such a huge challenge in every way. You know, physically, obviously, it was huge to run that far. Logistically, culturally, everything was by far the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life. So I went and did it, and it took me 23 days, I think, or was it 25? I can't remember. And it was, yeah, brutally hard. Came home to Scotland, and I was in such a slump because I was just so exhausted, and that took a long time to recover from. And as I was going through the recovery, one of my friends was over and she said, you know what, Jenny, I've never seen any of your pictures or your film from your little thing in Kyrgyzstan. Can I see it? And so we put it up in my living room and I was sitting there looking at my own images for the first time in months and just realized that was the most fun thing I have ever done in all my days. And I want to do it again. So I don't know if you guys know type 2 fun. Type 2 fun is something that becomes fun after it's done and you look back.
Okay, I've got you now.
So this was like an extreme type 2 fun, because I'm sure that when I ran across Kyrgyzstan, every day was hard and I cried a lot and it was brutal. But as soon as I looked back, I went, oh my gosh, that was the best thing I ever did. I want to do it again. And then I started researching which mountain range I would like to do. And I ended up with this long list. There's more mountain ranges than I think you realize, because they're all divided up into sub-ranges and stuff. So I had this huge list and thought, okay, well, if I just do one on every continent, then that kind of whittles it down, and then it's a thing. You know, there's at least a theme to what I'm doing here. So it was born, and I went off to Morocco just a few months after that to run across the Atlas. Again, couldn't find anyone in recorded history that had done it, and again, there was no route, no decent maps. I thought Morocco would actually be a lot easier, because unlike Kyrgyzstan, tourists actually go to Morocco. There are actually guidebooks on the country. But I think the mountains always punish the overconfident. It was really hard. It was hard in every single way, culturally probably the most, because, you know, in touristy parts of Morocco, you're okay. You know, women can probably walk around in what they'd wear at home, and that's completely going to be fine. But in other parts that don't have paved road access, you know, North Africa is one of the hardest places in the world to be a woman. I don't think we should beat around the bush with that. So I did kind of run into a lot of difficult situations that brought up quite a lot of questions for myself, what it means to be a free woman, getting to travel and do these things and practice sport.
What do you mean by difficult situations? Give me some examples.
The biggest situation for me was actually I was 5 days in and I was camped. So this is at night, and if you've ever been to the interior of Morocco, the best night skies you will ever see. I was lying there in my bivy, so I don't have a tent. I was lying there in my bivy looking up this insanely beautiful night sky, and I'm in a really, really remote place when suddenly I hear the roar of an engine. And before I know it, two jeeps have shown up, and I'm nowhere near a road. So how they got there to this day, I don't know. Two jeeps showed up and 10 men, most of them carrying guns, pile out of the jeeps. And then I'm lying there in my bed looking up these 10 guys, and they're all screaming at me in a mixture of Arabic and French. And all I can really understand is they're saying, get in the jeep. And I don't really know which part of my instincts came in at that point that I just thought, well, I'm not getting in that jeep under any circumstances. And so I actually just said no thanks. Good night. That didn't work. We had this back and forth that these 10 guys did insist that they were part of the gendarmerie, the rural police in Morocco. None of them were wearing uniforms, so I still, you know, definitely wasn't getting in the Jeep. The Jeeps weren't marked. But anyways, they weren't going to leave me alone. I wasn't, you know, me versus 10 armed men. And in hindsight, I'm flattered they thought it would take 10 of them, but it was kind of overkill. What they were trying to say to me was that it was dangerous, that I couldn't go camping because that was just exceedingly dangerous. And what they wanted me to do instead was to come with them back to the nearest village. And I'd stayed in that village the night before, so I wasn't going back because I'd taken 55 kilometers to run out of it. And I didn't want to do it again. But also that village had been one of the most dehumanizing experiences I think I've ever had as a person, as a woman. In Morocco, women typically can't go to public places like cafes and restaurants. And when you've just run through the desert, the first thing you want to do when you get to a village is sit in the shade and have a cold drink. But I wasn't allowed. I was told no at every venue. And there was only one hotel in town. And they did allow me to stay in a room, which I'm still grateful for because I know that that was big for them. But I had to sneak in through a neighboring business door. They wouldn't let me go through the front door, or else I would disgrace the whole premises. And even just walking around the streets in this particular village was quite uncomfortable. And so I was looking at these 10 men of the gendarmerie who were telling me that here I was camping under this beautiful night sky. That was exceedingly dangerous, but I would be safer in this village that did not allow women to have freedom of movement. And I just found that really shocking. And, you know, the police force out there are, of course, 100% Arab males. They don't have any diversity, so they don't have these voices challenging them. That was the introduction to my relationship with the gendarmerie. They participated in my whole expedition after that date, actually.
So how did it resolve itself?
That night, they all hiked with me. All 10 of them helped me pack my backpack. You know how, like, some jobs are best done by one person, not 10?
It's a bit like Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we all packed up my backpack, and all of us hiked off into the night to the nearest Berber camp. So they knew some Berbers nearby, and they just banged on the door in the middle of the night and said, you know, this girl actually thought she was going to sleep outside. Can you believe it? She's staying with you. So a Berber house is typically two rooms. There'll be one living room / kitchen, and then there'll be the sleeping room. And the sleeping room will just be full of mattresses and blankets. And when everyone goes to bed at night, they just pull out their own stuff and lie down. But men and women who are not related cannot be in the same room. So this is the middle of the night. And I mean, even grandpa had to be kicked and woken up and put into the kitchen to sleep so that I could sleep in the bedroom. And I was just mortified by the situation. The 10 men of the gendarmerie and this entire Berber family tucked me in, put me to bed in the sleeping room. And in the morning, I actually found that I'd been locked in, that they'd locked the door from the outside to make sure that I didn't attempt to go into the wilderness again. So we didn't get off on a very good start. It was a really complicated situation.
Did that make you even more determined to keep going on? Because you're just trying to get away from these people.
Yeah, I mean, one was this overwhelm of these guys being around me all the time. So after that, they really did keep an eye on me, and they always knew where I was. You know, there's no hiding in Morocco. There's not like trees and stuff that you can disappear behind. It's very hard to disappear. So one was just this overwhelm. You know, I think I like running in the mountains quite a lot because I am an introvert. I really do like this quiet time. And now suddenly I'm being chased by men in a country where relationships between men and women are very complicated. So I kind of had this overwhelm of these guys. But also, like, I had now set myself a reputation. I dug my heels in and said I wasn't getting in the Jeep, that I'm doing this expedition, that I'm going to be successful, that women can do stuff. And, you know, I had made a whole scene about it. So there was no way I was going to fail under their watch. Like, the pressure of carrying pretty much the sisterhood across Morocco was how I felt, that I had to show these guys that it would be fine, that I had the skills, that I had the determination. Like, it was just... Yeah, I put a lot on my shoulders to do that one.
When you started off in Kyrgyzstan, you know, because I mean, you've done all this planning at home, it is genuine exploring because there's no maps, there's very little information. You know, you've really got to rely on your wits when you get there. How were you greeted there? How did they respond to you when you said, this is what I'm going to do?
Quite negatively, but in a nice way, if I can say that. Obviously, the only thing I couldn't fly with was my gas canisters for my stove. So the first thing I had to do in Bishkek was buy gas canisters, and only the mountaineering office sold them. So I went in, and the guy said, "Oh, what are you going to do on your holiday?" And so I said, "Oh, I'm going to run across the country. I've got a backpack, you know, going to sleep outside, going to be great." And this guy just, he looked me up and down, and he just went, "No. No, no, no. Let me explain to you." And then he did this whole mansplaining thing about how Kyrgyzstan was really big, how the mountains were really big. Once I got there, there wouldn't be any hotels, you know. It would just be the wilderness. What was I going to do without a hotel? And there's nothing out there. And
there's no hair dryers, you know.
There's no hair dryers. Nowhere to plug one in. Really ridiculous situation. So I just wasn't having it. And he had a map on the wall, and I said, "No, no, buddy, trust me. This can be done. I'll show you." And I showed him my route. And he followed along. He knew his country really well. And to my utter relief, he went, "You know what, actually, this is a really good route. I think it would go. But, and this, I mean, I will never forget this conversation as long as I live." The way that he delivered the line, he looked me up and down and he said, "But not by you." And he made it really clear his feelings that women could not go alone into the outdoors. He'd never seen it before. You know, not only had no one run across Kyrgyzstan, but he'd never met women that could go solo. And the thing, I'd been really excited about the concept of doing a world first. You know, we live in an era where it seems like all the good exploring is done and world firsts have all been ticked off. So I was really excited by it. And I didn't pause to think about the fact that if something's never been done, people genuinely believe that it can't be done. And that's why it hasn't been. And so almost everyone that I met in Kyrgyzstan kind of did the same thing. People were really lovely. People always wanted to help me. I was invited into homes all the time. Like, the hospitality was fantastic. So I don't want to say anything negative against the Kyrgyz people. But they were all unanimous in their opinion that I would fail, that I would hurt myself, that this was a terrible idea, and I just needed to be put on a horse and taken back to the village. You know, it was mentally just really taxing every single day because, you know, my mind was filled with doubts all the time. I didn't think I could do it. Like, it was so hard. It was so much harder than anything I'd ever done. The scale was overwhelming. And then to have every single person in the country believe that I would fail, I just felt like I'd lost my mind, that I was out there doing something that everyone knew I wouldn't be able to do.
So effectively, you're running, what, about 35 miles a day?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I think I averaged 45 kilometres, so...
Right, so you're running a marathon. You're running a marathon every single day in life, plus 5K.
Yeah, but, like, taking all day to do it, you know.
You toss it off as if it was something light. You've got everything you need on your back. Is it daunting? Is it liberating? Is it just a fantastic way to clear your mind? Tell me.
You know, it's all those things, and it bounces between them. It is really daunting to have that kind of distance ahead of you and not know if you're going to hold up to it, if the stuff in your backpack is going to hold up to it. Mountains are volatile. We can never forget that the mountains make the ultimate call. Anything can change, anything can happen, and that's daunting. You've put yourself in a very vulnerable position to go solo into them. But also, it is the ultimate freedom. Going on foot with just the stuff on your back, and you don't need anything else, and you can stay out there for days before you run out of food and need to see civilization again. You know, that is a feeling of freedom that I've never experienced anywhere else. You know, no other sport can give that to me because I usually have some equipment that I need to maintain or something like that. But this is, you know, just my little legs that have to keep ticking over. And you know, when you get tired, you set up your bivvy and you sleep. When you get thirsty, you reach down into a stream and you get some water. And yeah, it's just, it's so pure.
You actually had a really scary moment on the journey in Kyrgyzstan, which you write about in the introduction to Tough Women. What went wrong there, and how did you manage to pick yourself up and carry on?
Hands up, it was completely my fault. It wasn't an accident, it wasn't the force of the mountains. It was, I was maybe getting cocky and not taking the time that I should have with my navigation. You know, like we said, there wasn't a route, there wasn't a map, so I had to really make it up. So I was doing things on, like, satellite images, basically. And I didn't check enough to know that the valley that I'd chosen to go down was going to go wrong. So I ended up going down this valley, and there were some landslides, which was kind of scary, but it was fine. I got over them, but I set them off again. So I remember saying to myself, no matter what happens, I'm not going back that way. This valley has to go because those landslides are going to break a femur if I go over them again. You know, they were pretty big. And then sure enough, I turn the corner and I can no longer go forward. The valley doesn't go, it's turned into a gorge. So it's either white water or a sheer wall. And so I sit there and think to myself, well, I can't go backwards, I can't go forwards. So that means either down into this white water or up over this mountain and, you know, climb over to the pass and get into the valley on the other side. And I thought they both were kind of death on a stick, but the climb was a little bit less deathly. So I went for it. It was my only free solo. Oh my gosh, I would never, ever free solo is what I learned that day. I'm not a very good climber. And obviously I was doing it without any appropriate safety, and I just had to scramble up this mountain. I remember literally dangling at one point. I hated it. I don't know how long it took me. I've still never looked at the GPX file for the date, so I don't actually know how long I was there. I don't know how big the climb was, because I just don't want to know, because when I look at it, I will have to see how stupid my mistake was. You know, I know that I made a navigational error. I don't really want to have to, you know, I spent a lot of time giving myself a hard time about this episode. I don't need to do it again. So anyway, so I had this long climb, and I knew that if I made a mistake, I would die. You know, it was quite clear to me, because at one point there was a tree, and so I scrambled towards this tree that I thought I could have a break. I can sit on the root of this tree and rest. But as soon as I got to the tree, the entire thing, which was, you know, about the size of both of my legs, came out in my hand. And like, because the slope was just really dry, and it just fell to the bottom. I remember hearing how long it took until the tree splashed into the water, and thinking to myself, right, I wouldn't survive that fall. If I slip once, that's that. So it was, you know, this prolonged near-death experience. I had all this time climbing to think about my life, think about my mistake, think about what I would lose out on if I messed this up. And I swore to myself that this expedition was over. That everyone I've met that said I can't do this, they were right, and I'm just going to have to humbly go back to Bishkek and fly home, because this is not, I don't belong out here, I can't do this. And so I had quit. I did say the words, I definitely agreed that I was quitting. But I got to the top, somehow I survived, and there was a beautiful green valley on the other side, a very safe place where I should have been in the first place. And as soon as the adrenaline left my body, I just had this massive cry. I don't think I've ever cried this hard as an adult. I just sat down and I cried the whole thing out. And then what I didn't expect was I just suddenly stopped crying. I fixed my ponytail. I got up and I just kept going. And I just didn't discuss it until I'd finished the whole expedition, until I got all the way to Osh. But yeah, I just pretended it didn't happen. I just brushed it off. I was way more careful after that, but yeah, I just got back up and kept going.
Do you think that was some kind of muscle memory in a way, that actually, because you'd been so far, you were kind of, your body was, your being was programmed in a way just to carry on? What do you think it was?
Yeah, I love that. I've never thought about it that way. But yeah, I think a lot of the time when you're going through a difficult situation in an endurance challenge, the easiest thing is to just keep going. And I actually think that quitting is the hardest thing, because quitting means that now you have to make new choices and you have to figure out something in order to get home. But continuing, even if you should or shouldn't continue, is always the easiest thing, because that's what you know, that's what you plan to do. It's just keeping those legs moving, and nothing new has to happen. You don't have to think about anything. So yeah, definitely, I was probably in a very overwhelmed place when that happened. So getting up and continuing running in the direction that I wanted to keep running in was the easiest thing on my mind.
I've been privileged to talk professionally to quite a few adventurers over the years who've been to extraordinary places and done extraordinary things, and I must confess, I'm none the wiser. Because what I struggle to understand is why. What drives you to do it?
That is a good question. I think a lot of things. You know, you're not doing it for one reason. This is, you know, something that's encompassing so much of your life that it's going to obviously be a lot more intricate than that to anyone that does it. For me, there's kind of two parts. One is what's inside. That's just for me. I do find, as far as an education and personal growth goes, nothing beats this form of pushing my limits of really pushing myself so far out of my comfort zone. And that's when you really expose your true self to yourself. And that's where you find out what you're made of, find out what you can be made of, and grow so much. I mean, my biggest life lessons all came from adventure. And I think that's been so empowering, and that's shaped the woman that I am. And it's different every time. I think I always get the lesson that my life needs. You know, in Kyrgyzstan, it was very much about believing in myself, that I probably didn't have that up until that point in my life. I was in my 20s, and you know, I agreed with people when they said I couldn't do stuff, and that showed me I need to stop that and stand up for myself. I get all that when I push my limits this way. The other motivation is, of course, I've started sharing this stuff publicly. You know, I produced this book to make a point that this is a great place that everyone should be, and I really, really want other people, and especially young women and girls, to have these experiences that I've had. Maybe not the exact same ones. I don't want anyone to dangle from a ledge. Push yourself out of your comfort zone and grow as a person and believe in yourself and be empowered in the ways that me and all the other women in this book have. And I just genuinely believe the world would be a better place if more people explored and more people adventured and more people grew in these ways.
Talking about being out of the comfort zone, let's focus in on your experience in the Bolivian Alps now, because there was a lot of fear surrounding that, wasn't there? Mainly because of what people were telling you.
Yeah, I'm still kind of surprised how much fear affected me, because that was my third expedition. So by now I should know what I'm doing. I should have the confidence. I actually speak a bit of Spanish, so when I went to Bolivia, there was kind of this relief that I might understand something. But, you know, fear plagued the expedition. It was almost crippling at some points. There was a lot to be afraid of. Like, objectively speaking, it wasn't completely out to lunch that I was afraid environmentally. So this is by far the highest altitude I was going to have to go to. So I was over 5,000 meters several times. It's very, very remote. You're in a very, very poor country. If anything goes wrong, it's not great. But yeah, the biggest one was what people were telling me. Everywhere I went, you know, Bolivia is one of the world's poorest countries. It's got one of the worst records for violence against women. And everywhere that I went, I was told, you are going to be murdered. Don't go to the next village. They will murder you. Have you got a gun? If you haven't got a gun, you're going to get murdered. It was just constant warnings. And I've heard that stuff before. In a lot of places that I go, I'm always told. I mean, this is what it's like being a solo woman traveling the world. You're always told that it's too dangerous for you. You're always told that you can't go there alone. And so having almost a decade of traveling the world under my belt, I was really surprised that this one really got to me. And I think it's because I really did believe them. Because, you know, this is a part of the world where they aren't making it up. You know, there is the cocaine trade and the illegal mining trade. Here I was suddenly feeling very ashamed of how much I was almost flaunting the luxury of my life, running around with my, like, really high-end outdoor kit, having the luxury to take 3 weeks without work that I could just run in the mountains. And so every village that I went into, I went in just feeling utterly terrified, because I'd been told so many times that this was the village that would kill me. And then every single time, they turned out not to be the village that would kill me. They always welcomed me in with open arms. Well, not always, but for the most part, welcomed me in and showed me great hospitality and, you know, that very vibrant Quechua or Aymara cultures. But then it would just be when it was time to leave and I'd relaxed and I'd gone, you know what, you were being silly, everyone's nice. And just as I was packing up my bag to leave, they would say, which way are you going, gringa? And I would tell them and they would go, oh, no. Don't go that way. They're going to kill you. And it just went on. You know, every single day I woke up so scared of everything that I was up against. It wasn't just the prospect of being murdered. You know, it really was the mountains. You know, I got hit by really bad weather throughout the whole expedition and the exposure. And I woke up every single day in my bivy, which would be frozen. There'd be a layer of ice on it because you're in the Andes. And I would just lie there in my bivy and think, I just can't. I just don't want to. I am too scared. And I would have to have the fight with myself every day to get my bag packed and get going again. Every single morning until the very end, I did this routine.
Are you just bloody minded?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You touched on something else there too that, you know, that I am genuinely curious about. Is it expensive being adventurous? I mean, how do you manage to afford it?
I'm self-employed and a freelancer, which means that for me, I do get to make my schedule. So when I'm home in Scotland, I just work really hard knowing that I'm going to go away for a month and not work. And that's really my biggest expense, is the fact that I'm out in the wilderness, which means that any responsibilities in my life cannot find their way to me, which is very thrilling. But also, you know, you obviously have to have a lifestyle that allows for that. And of course, I've made the sacrifices along the way to still be doing that. Once you're there, it's not at all expensive. You know, I'm sleeping under the stars. I'm eating what's local, just got what I can carry. So it's, you know, it is what you make it. There's certainly different budgets for different types of trips. But yeah, I think the most expensive part is the personal sacrifices in my life to be away so much.
When you say personal sacrifices, what do you mean?
Just that I'm not around as much. You know, I do end up missing quite a lot in my social life, in my professional life, and everything that, you know, I'm kind of half the time at home. I mean, this is pre-COVID, obviously, but I would be half the time at home and half the time traveling. And that's what makes me the best version of myself. So everyone who is close to me completely understands that. If I was around all the time, I wouldn't be the person that I am. So they have to be happy that I've left again, because I'll come back a happier human.
I'm sure it makes you all the more sparkling and intriguing when you do make an appearance in people's lives.
Oh, I'm a nightmare when it's been too long since I've been camping, trust me.
I'd like to talk about New Zealand now. And there was a different thread to that one. This is the Southern Alps in New Zealand. And you set yourself a quite stringent target to complete this within a particular time frame, but things didn't necessarily work out as you wished, and that bred a bit of frustration.
Yeah, so, I mean, up until now, we've done three world-first expeditions. We've been to gnarly mountains, done things that no one's done, and had to make a path and a culture that didn't understand or accept me. And so when I went to New Zealand, I thought, am I letting myself down? I mean, everyone's been hiking and running. I mean, I'm going to be sharing the trails with tons of women that look just like me. There were GPX files that I could just download for the whole route. You know, I didn't even have to work very hard at planning an expedition. It really felt like a holiday. And of course, I was looking forward to it. I mean, if you've seen the Southern Alps, they are stunning. I was really delighted to go to New Zealand, but I thought, am I letting down the challenge by doing something that's objectively a bit easier? So I thought, I'll just keep it the same level of hard. I'll just have to make it hard in another way. So I'll set myself a target to do this in 20 days or less. And the thing that punched me in the face when I got to the Southern Alps that I didn't account for is that, of course, in the developing world, all trails exist because they need to go. Trails are for people to get to work, to their crops, to the next village, to make trade. All the trails that do exist are for a purpose. Whereas in the Western world, trails are for leisure. The middle class would kick off if you made their trails too easy. And oh my word, the stuff that goes in New Zealand would be a Via Ferrata in Europe. Trust me, these people just love a good scramble. And so the trails were gnarly. The trails were really, really hard. So this mileage target that I'd set, based on having done these three expeditions at a marathon a day, I thought, well, in easy New Zealand, I should be doing at least 60, 70 kilometers a day because it's going to be so much easier. And I just got absolutely slammed by that idea. I spent so little time running, so much time on my hands and feet trying to scramble up and down stuff. You know, there were days when I went right until after dark and I would turn off my watch and I would look at it and think it was broken because it said I'd done 28 kilometers in the whole day. And I would just, you know, I was exasperated and I was pushing myself so hard. I was waking up before dawn and going until after dusk and just pushing and pushing and never stopping to soak it in, never stopping to chat or embrace or, like, you know, have a nice time, because I was just so stressed about how slow I was going. It sucked a lot out of me because I was feeling so negative about myself and I wasn't being able to celebrate what a beautiful place it was. Until one day I had... I think I woke up and realized I had a pretty easy day. I was just going to go over this very small pass. I think it was 400 meters. And then I had a long road or gravel run out into my next resupply, which was going to have chocolate at it. So I was motivated. It was going to be an easy day. And then this pass that was so small. In New Zealand, they have routes and tracks. Track is where there's actually somewhere to put your feet. a root is just like these little orange triangles that they've put on trees and in fields to just give you a message of hope that this is the right way to go, but like there's no actual trail to put your feet on. So it's generally a lot of scrambling and bushwhacking. And this day was like that. It was actually a river that I had to clamber all the way up to get over the pass and then all the way down. It was like serious bouldering. It was really hard work and it was so slow. And, you know, when I look back, it was actually like so fun because I spent 7 hours bouldering, which was really cool. But I never stopped the whole day. I pushed myself so hard because I was going so slow and I really wanted to get to my resupply. And I remember looking at my watch and realizing that in 7 hours, this is my world record day, by the way, in 7 hours, I'd done 4 kilometers. And I was just like, oh my God, no worries. I'll put on my head torch and I'll run all night. I'm going to make the resupply. And so I left and I literally just collapsed. I just like, I wish someone had been there to see it because it would have looked like a cartoon. I just fell flat on my face, just absolutely fell from exhaustion. And I was right near a hut. New Zealand's got quite similar to our Bothy network. They've got huts over there, a little bit newer because they're hunting lodges mainly. But I was right next to one of these huts and I just thought, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to start a fire and have a nice night and read my book and like, you know, go to bed before 10 for once. And I kind of looked back on my day and I looked back on the 2 weeks that I'd had and I realized, you know, this was such a magical landscape. I was so privileged to get to be here. I was having so much fun doing really cool, really difficult trails. And there was no hope at all that I would do this in less than 20 days. So I just needed to kiss that goodbye and start to enjoy this. And that was what I did was, you know, I let go of that measure of what I thought I needed to live up to and just said, you know what? There's other reasons to go to the mountains aside from checking off some kind of gnarly challenge. You know, you can just enjoy this. And yeah, so that was a good growth experience, that one.
It's one of the things I admire an enormous amount about what you do. I can look at other people who you might describe as professional adventurers or professional mountaineers or whatever, you know, and it becomes an exercise, not in commercialization, but, you know, there are targets, you know, they are earning a crust by doing what they do and they have to keep on pushing it and advertising themselves and so on. With you, it seems to be more about the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally understand that. That is kind of the game of being a professional adventurer is, you know, it does have to be valuable. And I think we've always had a culture of first or fastest. You either need to be the first person to do something or the fastest person to do something, and everything else doesn't count. And I think what really struck me was, you know, when I started doing public talks and getting to do more events and meeting people who adventure, was people would say things to me, like, really apologetically about their own adventures. They'd say, well, oh, I'm only doing the West Highland Way, blah, 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 because I've got family or whatever. And I'd feel so sad about that we've created this culture where people think there's no value to doing that because it wouldn't make the news or something. I thought, no, the West Highland Way is awesome. Go do it. Like, you know, and celebrate
it.
And
enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. And if it takes you a week to do it, that's not like, just take a week and enjoy the West Highland Way. Like, why do we make people feel like if it's not a first or fastest, it doesn't have any value to anyone, including yourself? And so that's something that I've really tried to not participate in, even though I have done a few firsts and I have also, you know, done some fastest. When I look back on that stuff where I was objectively successful, that wasn't what I took away from it. You know, I'm not proud of what happened in Kyrgyzstan because no one had done it before. Like Asa, I am proud that no one had done it, but that's not in my top three reasons why running across Kyrgyzstan was a fantastic experience for me. So of course there's pressure to be a professional in the industry and produce results like that, but I feel quite lucky that I share these stories and people do enjoy them and find value in them, and that's what I think is more important.
Jenny, I was having a look at your website and I noticed that you've ticked off another one this year, which is surprising given the global circumstances at the moment. Is that why you're in Canada just now?
I mean, I'm so lucky in all of this that having a Canadian passport and coming home, I needed to be with my family anyway, so I did come home. And then the parks opened up and the provincial borders opened up and I realized my dream to run across the Rockies could happen. I went out and did the Rockies this July. It was actually my first time being home since, or like being back in that range since, you know, moving to Scotland and being a professional adventurer that gets to go around the world and do other things. I don't think I've fully digested it yet. It was hard, as I expected it to be. I think there was a lot of the devil you know when it came to this, that the other mountain ranges I was nowhere near as apprehensive about as I was the Rockies, because that's where I learned to hike. That's where I discovered trail running. That's where I learned how to camp and to, I learned all my backcountry skills. So I already knew from my whole childhood how punishing the Rockies can be. And so when you go into it knowing exactly how much it's going to hurt, knowing how cold it gets at night, knowing how big the swarms of mosquitoes are, it's so much easier to be afraid. It definitely affects your mental game.
You put this, or you edited this book, Tough Woman, Adventure Stories, and it's subtitled Stories of Grit, Courage and Determination. Why women?
You know what, 10 years ago, this is something that not only would I not have edited, but I wouldn't have even bought. Because maybe 10 years ago, I didn't see how much we do need this. I think when I started adventuring, I got told, no, you can't do this alone. But I had just started, so I just thought that was probably correct because I didn't know what I was doing. And I was so young and I was alone. And I thought that people would give me genuine, valid advice. And I had this fantasy that when I grew up and became, you know, I always wanted to do expeditions. And I thought, you know, once I've done something gnarly and big, I won't hear that anymore. No one's going to doubt me anymore because I'll have proven myself. And so that's what I thought I needed to do, was prove myself, and then no one will give me this negativity anymore. Now I'm in my 30s, and objectively speaking, I've definitely proven myself. And yet, when I do decide to go do outdoor pursuits, I mean, even just then, being in the Rockies, being in the place that I grew up, doing something for the fifth time, you know, I know what I'm doing, I still met so many people who were just didn't hide their amazement and say, I can't believe you're doing that alone. Did you really do that alone? Do you have a gun? That kind of stuff. And that's something that I've really realized is that because, and I would blame TV at the very top level for this, but all other media, that when it comes to adventurers that we see in the media, we see one demographic. And that's not an accurate representation of the outdoors. You know, we know that people who enjoy the outdoors are just spread over all types of humans. And yet we have this perception that exploration and expedition is just this one demographic. And I always get asked, if I give a talk or something like that, I always get asked, why aren't there more women in the outdoor industry? And I always struggle because there are plenty of women. I work in the outdoor industry full time and I'm usually working with women. They're everywhere, but they're just not getting the spotlight that those top guys are getting. And so I thought, you know, I've now built up a platform for myself that I could maybe do something about this. What could I do? And I thought, I know a lot of women that have amazing stories, and what if I put them all together in one book? And then now when I get asked why there are more women, blah blah blah, I can just hand over this book and say, here, there's tons, here's an example.
Can you give us some examples then of some of the women who are captured in this book and what kind of things they've done?
I tried to get a really good range of both types of women and types of things that they've done. So it really does span the whole globe. There's a good age range as well. So we've got Bendangi Kulkarni. She lives in Britain now. She's this Indian adventurer. The story that she writes about is when she cycled around the world, becoming the youngest woman to do so. And I think she was 21 at the time. I think she's 23 now. And she's absolutely killing it in this industry. And it just blows my mind. See someone so young just absolutely killing it. And then we've got Anne Daniels, who is at the other end of the scale, but she's really had this incredible career that now she's looking back on, and she's got a lot that she can give our industry as this woman who absolutely pioneered. You know, if I think that I've hit some funny conversations in my day and age, you know, I know Anne, who's been to the Arctic plenty of times and done some really great expeditions. Obviously, our local girl is Annie Lloyd-Evans, who's an outdoor instructor in Scotland. And she tells this beautiful story of pack rafting with a fat bike across Greenland, which is a place that I've never been. And just the way that she talks about nature, I've never met someone who's got such a good eye for nature and such a good soul for it, that she just writes really beautifully. And that's kind of the point of the book, is this isn't a series of essays about being a woman. These are just fantastic adventure stories, and they all happen to be written by women.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, because I know exactly what you mean about the normal demographic, you know, the one that the media jumps on. And it tends to be ex-military, you know, and at this stage, did you think you were going to die? And it's all, everything's got to be about jeopardy. The stories in this book, Tough Women, they just get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, in every industry, why it's key to have different voices. People who look at things in different ways. You know, women tend to approach problems in a different way than an ex-military guy does. You know, like, we are hearing one voice right now to represent the outdoor industry, when there are so many different ways to explore, there are so many different ways to enjoy the outdoors, so many different ways to approach life-threatening situations. So when we hear from more different types of adventurers, we explore more ourselves.
I'm quite intrigued, Jenny, about your view of the whole global pandemic at the moment, because it is restricting. What is your plan? What's your view on it all?
Yeah, it's obviously a really scary time for everyone. I've always really heavily relied on the outdoors and adventure for managing stress and managing mental health. And I think that's, for most of us, that's the biggest present fear that we're personally going to face is our mental well-being right now. As long as we're able to safely get outdoors, I think we all need to keep on going. And like you were saying, you know, adventure has just changed. You know, I'm not going to fly to the Andes, but I can do a new trail, or I can do an old trail for the 50th time, but try to do it faster than I've ever done it, or do it in a different direction, or whatever it is. Adventure is a mindset. Adventure is not a physical place. You don't have to go for a certain amount of time or be certainly far away from home or a different language. You know, adventure is just a mindset. And I think we all need to keep finding ways to adventure and keep ourselves well.
Jenny Tough, it's been a genuine pleasure talking to you. Some very interesting insights in amongst that. And thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Jenny's book, Tough Women, is out now and is published by Summersdale Press. And you can find all the details on our website, jennytough.com. You've no idea how difficult it is for me to say tough rather than tough. That's also where you can watch our fabulous films. You can get in touch if you have any ideas for people we should speak to on this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham, and Jenny Tough, thanks for listening.